I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. When people buy used goods and vintage clothes from Goodwill, that money helps fund job training programs, including a new effort to prepare people for careers in clean energy. Goodwill's Clean Tech Accelerator launched in 5 states last year and is now expanding to more. It offers paid training in solar installation, electric vehicle charger maintenance, and more.
Most people that come to us are coming to us because they're looking for a new opportunity. They have either been stuck in one particular industry or job and they're wanting to gain a new skill, and then they're wanting to provide a better life for themselves and their family.
Monique McDaniels is with Goodwill in South Carolina. Her chapter is training people to install and service HVAC systems and electric heat pumps, which can heat and cool a home without oil or gas. Participants get hands-on experience with the technology.
We'll have an actual lab where they'll be working on the actual machines. They'll be able to touch it, feel it, break it apart.
She says market research shows there are already well-paid jobs in her area for people with these skills.
You can come in with very little knowledge or experience. You can gain these skills and really create the quality of life that you're looking for yourselves and for your family.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Share music and voices from genres and cultures around the world, reflecting you and the rest of your community. You make CJSF diverse.
Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. We at New Dimensions thank you for your support. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Language is an important part of any society because it enables people to communicate and express themselves. For several centuries, indigenous languages have been dying out. The loss of these foundational ways of communicating passed down for millennia, along with their unique arts and cosmologies, may have consequences that won't be understood until it's too late to reverse them. The good news is that there is an increasing recognition of the value of native languages, and they are being resurrected, taught, and preserved. This recognition acknowledges that speech is not just a body of vocabulary or a set of grammatical rules. As Wade Davis, anthropologist and ethnobotanist, says, it's a vehicle for which the soul of a culture comes through the material world. He goes on to say every language, in some sense, is an ecosystem of ideas, a watershed of thought, an old-growth forest of the mind. Today we'll explore the fascinating path of Calico Beamer Trapp. He's a man born in England who has ended up in Hawaii teaching Hawaiian at the Hale Olelo at the University of Hawaii in Hilo. He speaks Hawaiian 90% of his day and also acts as a translator in courtroom proceedings when any Hawaiian-speaking person requests it. Join us for the next hour as we explore the significance of preserving and teaching the indigenous Hawaiian language with our guest, Kaliko Beamer Trapp. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Kaliko, welcome.
Aloha, Justine. How are you?
Aloha. Back at you. I'm fine. Yeah. Thank you. It's great to be here on your beautiful, beautiful island. I've come over here to meet with you, but also for the Merry Monarch Annual Hula Festival. So I'm just very, very excited to be here.
Yeah, it's a beautiful festival. Yeah,
I'm looking forward to it. I'd like for us to start, if you would help our listeners know how a man from England ended up in Hawaii teaching Hawaiian language.
Yes, well, it starts many years ago. In 1970, I was born on a small island off the south coast of England called the Isle of Wight. And when I was there, I grew up, went to school, and then in the late 1970s, my parents divorced and my mother moved to California in the United States. It wasn't long before I decided I wanted to be there as well. And so I moved to California in 1982. When I was there, I met many people who were involved in a Hawaiian and Polynesian dance group because I had a sweet eye for a sweet girl who was my first girlfriend at the time, who was dancing Beamer-style hula, which we will probably mention in a few minutes, for this Polynesian dance group. And so I saw them performing. I was 15 years of age in 1985, and I thought, oh, wow, this looks great. I really enjoyed the Tahitian drumming, especially. So I joined their classes and learned through the community classes that they were offering how to play Tahitian drums and to play the ukulele and the guitar and so on. And I got really into it. That was my focus of time. Every day, that's all I would think about. I was really into it. And then in 1987, I met a lady who actually had been seminal in forming the group. Her name was Auntie Nona Beamer. She came over to California, to Walnut Creek, where we were based, because the original lady who had founded our group had passed away, and she was one of Auntie Nona's students in the 1940s. So what happened was we met there in California at a performance. I met Auntie Nona, and we just got along like bread and butter, you know, just super well. And I became a pen friend with her, really. She was living here in Pahoa, which is close to Hilo town here, and we became pen friends. And at the time, also, I was trying to learn Hawaiian language, but I couldn't find anywhere to really learn Hawaiian.
Just say something about your attraction to her. I mean, what was that? I mean, she picked you out or something?
Well, yes, she kind of did. What happened was, you know, Auntie Nona had arrived over there, and we all knew what a special lady she was.
About how old was she at that time?
Oh, she was born in 1923, so she was in her late 60s,
okay.
I suppose.
All right.
And so she was a cultural icon here in Hawaii. She had done an awful lot to help Hawaiian culture be recognized as something valuable again for the Hawaiian people. She had been teaching for 40 years at Kamehameha Schools, which is an esteemed school, private school here in Hawaii. She'd been teaching for all those years. Her classes were open to all of these young kids who wanted to learn her hula and of her stories and how to chant and all of those things. And those children grew up and became some of the big movers and shakers in the Hawaiian Renaissance, which we should probably cover too, for the 1970s, the Hawaiian Renaissance. So by the time she came to California in 87, to our remembrance performance for the lady who had founded the group, and as a thank you to Auntie Nona for having made the whole thing possible, you know, I already was in great awe of her. And there I was. She always used to say the story that, you know, here is this haole boy, a white boy, dancing with the Tongans and singing with the Tahitians and playing music with the Hawaiians and doing haka with the Maori on stage, you know, just seemed like such an unusual thing to see. And I think Auntie Nona sort of, I don't know why, but she really took a liking to me. The fact that, you know, I was in like a completely different way of expressing myself than what you would think. I mean, you would think maybe a boy of my age would be out, you know, having fun on the town or something. I don't know. But why was this Haole boy involved with Hawaiian and Polynesian things? It really probably fascinated her. And I had also made my first attempt at making a lei. And of course, a lei, you string flowers together. I had gone to the flower market in San Francisco and I had bought plumeria flowers and I had strung a lei for her, which was terrible. I mean, it was a really horrible looking lei. I didn't know really how to make lei, you know. I just asked a few people and of course I had seen lei before, but usually fake flower lei that we would wear. So anyway, I tried to make a real lei and it had all sorts of gaps in it, which is not what you want when you make a lei. And I presented it to her with my love. And of course, she said, "Oh, thank you, darling. This is a beautiful lei," and so on. Anyway, that kind of sealed the friendship right there. She was very happy. And yeah, that's really how that started.
I love that idea that this young man took the time to make a lei, however badly it was put together, and her appreciation of that. And that said something about you, deeply about you, how you respected the culture in some way.
Yeah, and I don't really know why that grew in me. And at that time, it was really just a small seed and a small little, I'm trying to think of the English word, it's like a little sprout growing out of the ground, if you will, that was inside my soul for Hawaiian and Polynesian things. But coincident with Auntie Nona's arrival was the departure of my mother and stepfather to go back to Europe. And when that happened, I decided that I wanted to stay in California, and I moved in with some Tongan people, you know, a family from Tonga. Actually, there were 14 of us, including children, in a two-bedroom apartment.
Oh, what a crowd.
Yes, in Pleasant Hill, California.
And I think of them as fairly large people.
Oh,
too.
They are large people. Yes, indeed. Yes. And I was a scrawny, skinny little Haole boy, or, you know, palangi, as they would say. And so what really turned me on living with them was that I was starting to learn Tongan language. And I thought, wow, now when we sing Tongan songs, I can understand a few of these words and I know I'm saying them right and so on. And that, you know, that was the spark that really made me interested in the language of Polynesia, languages of Polynesia. And I thought, oh, maybe one day I can get into Polynesia proper myself and go to Tonga and maybe go to live over there and do whatever one would do in Tonga. I had no idea at the time. And eventually Hawaii became the entry point to Polynesia because it was the easiest place to get to, but also because in 1994, after many years of communicating via letter, Auntie Nona sent word that she wanted me to come to Hawaii. And so I moved over here with 2 weeks' notice. I just left everything. I jumped on the plane with a few suitcases and I arrived here in Hawaii. And I ended up living with Auntie Nona in that late summer of 94. And then she said, oh, well, you need to go to UH Hilo and attend classes. And I, through
that's
being
the
here, that's the university here, University of Hawaii at Hilo. And I attended Hawaiian language classes in the summer of 94, actually. And then that's how my story started with learning Hawaiian officially.
That's quite amazing. I mean, you almost got commissioned then. I mean, a royal invitation that is not to be refused, so
right,
to speak.
Right, yeah. It was, you know, I'm so fortunate. Although Auntie Nona took many people under her wing. I mean, many, she gave the push to many local kids, hundreds of them, to explore Hawaiian culture, including language, of course, to explore Hawaiian culture and to love Hawaiian culture in hula, in storytelling, in dance, in puppetry, chanting, all aspects of Hawaiian culture and arts. And so I was just one of them. But what I think was slightly different about me was that she had picked me out from the mainland and brought me over here to be with her.
I want to remind our listeners who I'm with, and I'm going to remind people of his website. So before I do that, I want to ask you, what is on your website before I give the website?
Thank you. Well, I have a website where I have Hawaiian language instruction and some cultural knowledge and little interesting things to learn about Hawaiian culture and language. And I tried to make it available to as many people as possible. And I thought, well, the best way to share that knowledge that I've gained from Auntie Nona and from all these other sources is to put it on the internet, because it can go far and wide and around the world. So that's the website. It's basically to learn Hawaiian language and culture on the internet.
Exactly. Thank you. So I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Kaliko Beamer Trapp, and he is the creator of this website, olelo.online.com. And you spell olelo, O-L-E-L-O, online, O-N-L-I-N-E. olelo.online.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
He akumako, he o mai o e. O kavo hiku kapulani hei noa.
With Kaliko Beamer Trapp, and he is the creator of the oleloonline.com, teaches Hawaiian language both in the university and online and wherever else he can do it. You're a musician, you play the ukulele, you do it all, I think, and you're an enthusiastic supporter of the spread of this beautiful language. And absolutely. I want to say it is a beautiful language. It's beautiful to the ear. And as I was coming over, I was talking to different people about where I was going. You know, you're in the terminal and you're sitting next to someone, you have a conversation. And this person said, the Hawaiian language is one of the most beautiful languages in the world. And she had traveled all over the world and had heard many languages, and she considered the Hawaiian language as one of the most beautiful to the ear. Would you agree?
Yes, certainly. I think one of the most important aspects of that is that every word ends in a vowel. So whenever you hear Hawaiian spoken, you have that nice vowel ending to every word, and it allows for the flow of the word to go into the next word very smoothly and melodically, of course, combined with intonation and the way that we use rhythm in our voices, the way that we use stress in our voices, that is, you know, word stress, and then intonation in general. That is particularly Hawaiian. And it's different from English. It's not perhaps as harsh as English. It doesn't have as many odd consonants, if you will. We have just a few consonants and our five vowels. We have 13, quote-unquote, letters of the alphabet. That's all we need. And we can talk about everything and anything at any time. And so that's how it's been since time immemorial.
That's so beautiful. So give us some example. Let's say in the Hawaiian language, there are many, many, many words for rain, wind, moon, I think.
Yes.
You said, you told me that for moon, there are lots. So this morning, there was some rain. So speak about the rain this morning.
I ke kakayaka ni, no e nui kaua mahilo ni. Ahe mea makmauna ho I kaua mahilo ni. Kaulana o hilo I kaua kani lehua. Kaua noho I e kani ai na lehua o kana hele mauka ni. Oia kahi mea nani o hilo ni. Kaulana o hilo.
Oh, wow. So translate.
I just said that this morning we had some rain here in Hilo. And of course, it's the famous Kanilehua rain, which is the rain that rustles the lehua, the red lehua blossoms in the forest of the uplands where we sit today. And that's why Hilo is so beautiful with this famous Kanilehua rain.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. In this language, it's really important, I think, for anyone when they want to know a culture, truly know a culture, it might be helpful to learn the language.
Yeah.
So do you have any comment
on
that?
Oh, sure do. Yeah. So, you know, let me just take a step back. So when I was on the Isle of Wight as a young man, a young boy, I was associated with a family in France. They lived in the Haute-Savoie, which is in the mountainside of France, close to Geneve or Geneva. And my mother was a family friend with the mother in France. And when they were young, they used to do a family swap every summer. And the woman in France used to come to the Isle of Wight and stay with my grandparents. And meanwhile, my mother would fly over there and stay with those grandparents. And so when it came to my generation, my mother decided that she would send me to France every summer. And then their oldest girl would come to the Isle of Wight. And so being sent to France every summer, even when I lived in America, I flew back to the Isle of Wight and I would go to France, allowed me to experience learning a language from a quote-unquote immersion method, right? I mean, I had taken language classes at school, as one is required to do in England, but being sent to France and living with that family over there, there was no chance to speak English. They didn't want to speak English. As you know, French are very very persistent about that. They value their language very highly.
Persnickety.
And persnickety as well. And I stayed over there and I would learn really, you know, family language and so on. And what I loved about that and have loved ever since is that when I speak French, if I go to visit someplace like Tahiti, for example, and I'm speaking French over there, it's like I have a different personality. You can sort of channel that boy or that 10, 12-year-old boy who, you know, spent time living over there. I remember my time in the kitchen and in the living room and watching films and eating French breakfast and so on and working with them. Those things are my experiences, which make me who I am. But it's almost as if because it was in French language, it is associated with French culture to me and French behavior and French movement and French joking and the way your body moves, your eyes move, the expressions you might say. I just love the fact that that's sort of compartmentalized in my brain after many years of practice, that I can, you know, sort of become a different person when I'm there. I'm Simon, you know, when I speak French. Well, when I came over here to Hawaii, I became associated on the very first day of my arrival in Hilo. I became associated with a family that has Marquesan roots, that is in the Marquesas Islands, which lies between here and Tahiti, between Hawaii and Tahiti. And I ended up going down to the Marquesas many, many times between 1995 and 2011. That was the last time I went there. But I used to go every summer. As soon as school would end, I was teaching at the Hawaiian Immersion School here, and as soon as that class would end, I'd be on the plane on Saturday, fly straight down to Tahiti, head over to the Marquesas and stay there for 2 or 3 months and then come back to Hawaii. And that experience allowed me to learn Marquesan language to the point where I can discuss anything, just about anything, any time of the day, you know, continuously, not just a few phrases, but I mean, I can actually speak it. And that also has its own personality. I can, when I'm over there, I'm like a different person. I might look the same on the outside, but I feel that I can express myself differently the way they do. I can change my intonation and the pitch in my voice and the strength of my voice and the way my eyes move and the expressions that I make. I can change to match that environment and what the people there are like. And I just find that is so fun. I just love that. It's like you can be a different person again.
You know, in the United States, it's a fairly large territory, let's say. Yes. So you're not crossing like national boundaries a lot. In Europe,
there
are a lot of national boundaries. Yeah. And so it's natural for people to pick up many different languages.
Right, you fall asleep on the train in Europe and you're in a different country.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, close your eyes for a moment and there you are.
That's right.
But here in the U.S., we're not as emboldened to learn a language. Right. And I think we're bereft as a culture because of that, because we don't have that understanding that you're talking about the French people, their culture, their cosmology, or the Marquesans, or whomever. And here we're talking about the Hawaiians.
Yeah.
Why is it important to be teaching this to young children and bringing this into the culture? What is it doing for Hawaii and for the world then?
Right. Well, for Hawaii, I think, to answer the first part of that question, for Hawaii, it helps to maintain the indigenous culture that was here before the arrival of Westerners. That was, around 1778. So it's been quite a while now that we've had Western influence here in Hawaii. But I think with the fact that American and Western culture and ideas are coming into Hawaii so fast, especially with the arrival of the internet and all of that and media that is coming over from the U.S. mainland, that's really diluting the public consciousness about Hawaiian traditions, Hawaiian language, Hawaiian ways of doing things. And there are pockets of people in Hawaii who are striving to maintain that, whether it's taro farming, being a musician, performing in hula, language revitalization, all sorts of areas where navigation, for example, Polynesian navigation. There are these pockets of people who are really into retaining Hawaiian culture. And I think that is so super important for Hawaii, because otherwise it would be gone. There is no other place on the earth where Hawaiian cultural understandings are native, of course. I mean, by definition, here we are in Hawaii. We have native Hawaiians here. We don't have them anywhere else. They're not in Tonga. They're not in Tahiti. They're not in America. And they're not in India. They're only right here on these small little islands. And so, if we look back in time, we think about around 1982, there were only 2,000 speakers left of Hawaiian language, down from in the hundreds of thousands in the 1800s. So, it dropped down to a very few speakers. And that's a topic that will probably be very interesting to your listeners is about the revitalization of that. But for the world, it's like a flower garden. I mean, would it be good just to have only one type of flower that we would ever see on the earth? To me, all those different types of flowers are beautiful. You might think, wow, the plumeria is the most beautiful flower I've ever seen. And then you take a trip to somewhere else and you say, wow, I've never seen a tiger lily before, or wow, I've never seen a lehua, or I've never seen what, sometimes you don't know what's out there because you're only in your small little area and it's not even in your consciousness to know what else is out there. And that's the beauty of retaining native languages, because it's like all those various flowers around the world.
Kaliko, can you help us to highlight, let's say, one of the cultural blessings of the Hawaiian culture that can be preserved through its language? Is there anything that you could?
Well, I mean, we had just talked earlier tonight about wind and rain and moons and things like that. That understanding of how wind and rain and moons affect your life, that's a particularly Hawaiian thing. I mean, there's around Polynesia, there are similar ideas, but Hawaii has its own style of that. And what I mean by that is, for example, with rain names, we don't just say rain. We can. There's a general word, ua, which means rain. But every area has its own rain name, which is the type of rain that place has. And it's different from the rain at the other place, and it's different than the rain at the other place. We also have wind names, the same idea, the different winds that blow, the different fragrances that come from those winds, the feeling that they have. So the wind and the rain have names all over the place. And then we have the many types of rain, for example, many different words for the different types of rain. So that tells us that Hawaiians were thinking that rain and the different ways that the rain is expressed, if you will, the way the rain comes down, the way it touches you, the way it touches the land, that is something very important in Hawaiian culture. Otherwise, it wouldn't be named, you know, individually like that, I don't think. So